So our last segment is going to be on gastroesophageal cancer. We're happy to have Dr. Yelena Janjigian from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, Dr. Sam Klempner from the Mass General Hospital in Boston, and Dr. Fei Yin from Spring Hill, Florida, a Florida cancer specialist. Fei was a co-moderator on a prior module, and we're happy to have her back here again. So we're going to talk today about, we're going to start out talking about immune checkpoint inhibitors and then get into targeted therapy. Particularly interested to hear about anti-HER therapy, which we've been talking about a lot, as you can imagine, the entire weekend, but particularly interested to hear what you all have to say about it. So let's start out, Yelena, and you can maybe go through some data on checkpoint inhibitors.
Thanks for the opportunity to update you on what's new in our field. The field is constantly evolving. Here are the updates for this past year. These are my disclosures. So the biggest change in the field in the last year since we've been here in sunny Florida is that now the universe agrees that systemic therapy with FLOT, which is the triplet combination, is the preferred regimen. And now we have two level one evidence, New England Journal of Medicine published studies that show that radiation does not improve outcomes in this disease, and the battle is lost and won in the systemic arena. We also had the final overall survival analysis from KEYNOTE-811 study showing that dual immune checkpoint blockade plus anti-HER2 therapy improves survival in this first-line setting. Of course, we have approval of zolbetuximab in claudin-positive population, so the first-line setting is getting more nuanced, and it's important to do biomarker testing in all of our patients routinely, particularly since the ODAC met in the fall and decided to restrict the FDA approval for PD-L1, anti-PD-1 therapy in first-line setting for PD-L1-positive patients using CPS-1 or greater cutoff for immunotherapy. So just to start with first early stage disease in perioperative setting, as I mentioned, 90% of recurrences is in distant, not local. And if you have an experienced surgeon who's able to select patients appropriately and stage them with laparoscopy and other advanced imaging, you're able to get R0 resection without radiation. And I summarized here the key data, the cross versus surgery, the new AGIS showing ECX versus cross, and then of course FLOT versus ECX. And there's been a gradual logistical sort of logical progression showing that FLOT is the preferred regimen and the cross should not be used in adenocarcinomas. That being said, radiation has been hard to dethrone because first, carboplatin is easy to give, and secondly, because of CheckMate 577, where immunotherapy was the mainstay stay of perioperative or adjuvant therapy, because nivolumab was approved in adjuvant setting for patients who had high-risk disease and persistent T or N-positive tumors after carboplatin radiation. Now, you could say carboplatin is not a great regimen. It's not surprising they had a residual tumor, but that's the reality. This is the way that the study was designed. And it showed disease-free survival benefit. And it looked like there was benefit irrespective of PD-L1, but that status, you know, that data is quite a bit not conclusive. But essentially, because nivolumab was approved in adjuvant setting, irrespective of PD-L1 status, the community sort of stuck to that regimen. Now we have both Top Gear and SOPEX study that, because of the interest in time, I won't belabor sort of the finer points of the detail. These were New England Journal of Medicine papers, so you know where to find them. But essentially, it really tried to test the hypothesis, does the radiation add anything to systemic regimens, right? Because first looked at FLOT versus cross and then surgery, and then additional studies looked at escalation of addition of radiation to systemic chemotherapy. That's the Top Gear study at the bottom. Suffice to say, the curves are very clear. Radiation adds nothing. In fact, FLOT is clearly better than cross, as we predicted. And I can tell you, in my practice, I have not radiated a patient in probably close to 6 years. And it's, of course, I'm in a tertiary cancer center, I have experienced surgeons, but I would say if you're using radiation as a crutch, you're probably not selecting the right patients for surgery, and you need to start with prolonged systemic therapy. Hopefully, and this is just, right now preliminary data, but Matterhorn study will make it easier for you to use FLAD because it will bring immune checkpoint blockade in new adjuvant setting. Adjuvant is good, and we know from melanoma, from renal cell cancer, from lung cancer, neoadjuvant is better. Because the primary tumor is in place, the body is able to then expand this T cell population while you're recovering potentially later from surgery, perioperative therapy, and really suppress micrometastasis longer. So the Matterhorn study is a large study that looked at FLAT plus minus DERVA. It's classic FLAT, and it's the first study to test global approach of FLAT. So we were able to convince doctors in Korea, Japan, US, South America, and of course Europe. FLAT was born in Germany, so the mantra is always, well, only Germans know how to give FLAT. We don't know how to give FLAT. Well, that's not the case anymore. We were able to finish accrual ahead of schedule for the study during COVID. It's a really global study that enrolled patients with G-junction tumors and stomach cancer all together, and it showed a statistically and clinically meaningful improvement in pathologic complete response. Clinically meaningful, it comes with a little asterisk, because the truth is we don't have any definitive proof that pathologic complete response will translate to survival yet. But we do see no downstaging, and more importantly, we see that FLAT was delivered well and thorough and feasible to a global patient population. So even if Matterhorn is negative and does not show disease-free survival improvement, what we did show is that you can come up with a common platform for drug development for the future. Interestingly, non-Asia and Asia patients, the complete response and the delta is very similar. And North American patients, actually the delta numerically was higher. And again, this is just a number of small numbers. But it suffices to say we can give FLAT globally. 585 was a cautionary tale, similar study, but using doublet chemotherapy as opposed to triplet. And unfortunately, despite showing a modest improvement in complete response, the survival curves, although they shaped as if they should be positive, they're negative. And that's the numbers game and the design of the study and the way that the alpha was split, and the delta is not clinically or statistically significant difference here. So we definitely have room to improve, and hopefully the Matterhorn study will do that. Switching gears to metastatic setting, we know that, of course, CheckMate 649, KEYNOTE 585, and now all the tislelizumab rationale studies brought immunotherapy to first-line setting. So when CheckMate 649 was the first positive study, which led to nivolumab approval, and both nivolumab and pembrolizumab were approved irrespective of PD-L1 status. When Tisley came in on the market, or the application went in to ODAC, they filed it for CPS greater than 1, and that prompted an ODAC review. And after reviewing totality of the data and cost-effectiveness analysis and everything else, the decision was made in the fall to reverse irrespective of PD-L1 approval and restricted by CPS 1 or greater. Pembrolizumab is also approved in HER2-positive disease for PD-L1 CPS 1 or greater based on KEYNOTE-811 study, as I mentioned. In the United States, if you don't test and don't use immunotherapy in first-line setting, unless you're MSI high, which again, you should be using it in first line setting, you don't have access to it in later lines. Unlike Asia, where nivolumab is approved irrespective of PD-1 status in third line, in the United States, that's your only shot, is to use the drug in first line. KEYNOTE-811 is the phase 3 study that showed that in HER2 inhibition, particularly dual immune checkpoint blockade with anti-HER2 is helpful. And hopefully it will pave the way for a dual tumor targeting with anti-PD-1 blockade in the future. But this is a unique situation where PD-L1 overexpression goes up in HER2-positive tumors as you treat them with trastuzumab. And at baseline, most of these tumors are positive. In fact, in my practice, I've never encountered a PD-L1 negative HER2-positive patient. And this is just a paper to be aware of, the updates of survival. And this is going to be the benchmark to beat for the upcoming studies with other HER2 inhibitors that are coming down the pike, which is nice to have as an opportunity. CheckMate 649, of course, as I mentioned, was the three-arm study. The Nivo-Ipi arm was a negative study, but the FOLFOX versus FOLFOX Nivo continues to, we continue to update survival for, 4 years, 5 years out. We keep coming up with these updates, and what the exciting part is that these curves continue to be sustainably separated, and there is a subgroup of patients that survive long-term, and that's a big change for us. Even in my lifetime as an oncologist, that was not the case. Patients, the median OS in most of the studies did not even cross the one-year mark, and there certainly was not any long-term survivors. So tislelizumab is the, as I mentioned, the recent, more recent approval. And again, a lot of these drugs, pembrolizumab, and nivolumab, and tislelizumab, and other sintilimab, there's a lot of anti-PD-1 agents coming out of Asia and so forth. They have very similar mechanism of action. There's no real difference in efficacy. The way you typically choose these drugs is based on what's on a formulary at your hospital and or the dosing schedule. So if you want to give chemo every 2 weeks, you choose one drug. If you want to give it every 3 weeks, you choose another. As we mentioned, and Sam will be talking about it next, claudin inhibitors are entering the market, and often the number one question I ask is how do you prioritize these biomarkers? Even the pathologists, I was doing a summer at Yale, asked me that. And the way you do it is when do the survival curves separate, and how sustained are survival curves separation, and does it improve response rate, and how feasible is it to give these drugs in the clinic? And so I summarized for you SPOTLIGHT, GLOW, which is the claudin studies, and then immunotherapy studies and the HER2 studies. I would say the HER2 study is the gold standard, where the survival curves separate early and there's a really dramatic improvement in the response rate. The way that I think about claudin studies, certainly it's a first-in-class, it's an important biomarker, but it doesn't improve response rate, and although there's improvement in survival, it's a hard sort of combination to give. These patients are heavily medicated on a lot of medications. So now that the ODAC, as I mentioned, this is the threshold that was published in September of 2024. I was there for the meeting. Could have been an email. I think the decision was made before we even got there. But it does carve out space for claudin inhibitors because A, we're restricting by PD-L1, and B, we know that PD-L1 negative patients probably don't benefit as much as they would if they were high claudin positive from claudin inhibitors. So this is how I prioritize the biomarkers in metastatic and probably in early stage disease as well. Microsatellite instability, I wouldn't move at all before with chemo, radiation, surgery, anything, before you got MSI testing done in a patient. HER2 test, HER2 positivity is important as well. And then PD-L1, and you could decide whether or not you want to use CPS 1 or 5 as the cutoff and the threshold where you would pivot from immunotherapy to a claudin inhibitor. But the easy choices, for those of you studying for the boards, first three questions all come with immunotherapy, plus minus chemotherapy. Our disease is quite heterogeneous, so I prefer to give chemo with pretty much everything, including MSI-positive tumors, and the choice is FOLFOX. So in the last minute, the conclusion is that there's been a lot of development in our disease, and every year we come here because there's more and more drugs, and it seems confusing, but I think the only way you will get through these nuances is if you test for biomarkers and you test for biomarkers often. As Neil mentioned, HER2 inhibition is very important both in first line and later lines. We will get more T-DXd data at ASCO in second line with DG04. And DG03 is the data that's bringing these combinations potentially in first line. So knowing not only is the tumor HER2 positive or HER2 negative, but is it HER2 low or HER2 really high is important. And we're bringing all of these innovations to perioperative setting, which is exciting for our patients because now the standards are high. They don't just want to survive. They want to survive with their organs intact. So non-operative approaches are also coming, and it's quite exciting. Thank you for attention.
So in a second, Faye, you had brought up questions about sort of the epidemiology of gastroesophageal cancer that I want you to put out there. But first, because Faye also had a case, we don't need to present, it looks a little complicated, Sam, of MSI high a patient with MSI high in the GE junction. And I'm curious, first of all, we talked earlier today about upfront therapy with IO and rectal cancer, MSI high, even colon cancer. What about, you know, neoadjuvant IO, MSI high, gastroesophageal cancer, and then again, first-line therapy, metastatic disease?
Yeah, we have a couple data sets to pull from in the neoadjuvant, and this is actually now on the NCCN guidelines for gastric and esophageal. So strongly, yes, would be my answer to the first question. I would 100% incorporate checkpoint inhibitor into the neoadjuvant therapy for a locally advanced operable MSI-high gastric cancer.
You see path CR?
We do. There are two phase two data sets, both had a path CR rate around 60%. And actually, this one trial, the INFINITY trial, they now have a non-operative management where if you achieve a complete clinical response after neoadjuvant immunotherapy and PET scan and endoscopy, you're actually randomized to surgery or no surgery. Exactly what Dr. Janjigian was saying about looking towards non-operative strategies for these patients.
Yelena, anything you want to add to that?
I think most of the MSI patients will be cured. So you have to really select carefully what you will do for them. And I can tell you that most of the patients would elect to get either single agent anti-PD-1 or dual anti-PD-1 CTLA-4. They don't want surgery. That being said, if it's an elderly frail patient who's with distal gastric cancer and they're presenting, you know, with bleeding or some issue that you're concerned about, and subtotal gastrectomy is relatively straightforward and will be more definitive. Very rarely, sometimes we recommend that. And then we have data coming out, will be published soon, that in those patients, if they're MRD negative by ctDNA, you're done because they're going to be, knock on wood, cured. If they're MRD positive, then you have to do something. So I think the good news is, and that's what I tell my patients, 90% chance you're going to be cured. How we cure you, either with organs in place or without, that's, you know, up to the disease management team discussion.
In a patient who can tolerate, do you prefer CTLA-4 plus PD-1?
I, you know, hate to say this, and I would cringe to say this 15 years ago, but I think chemo immunotherapy is probably my preference because it's just hard. You know, I've seen too many MSS clones residual in these settings. So, and CTLA-4 blockade is not easy. So I either do single agent or start with FOLFOX, IO, and then de-escalate to IO alone, anti-PD-1.
So Sam, actually, maybe you can respond, at least initially. Faye, what were your questions about the issue about incidence of this disease?
The incidence?
Yeah, the epidemiology. You brought up the fact that in the United States versus Asia, et cetera.
Yeah, it's kind of strange to me because when I worked in Maryland, actually for 7 years, I did not see gastric cancer, even for single case. But when I moved to New Jersey, and then we have a lot of diversity, mm-hmm. and then I saw quite a few. And so I was thinking about the diet and then the race or anything plays the role of gastric cancer.
Also, diet, you know, and external factors. We'll start with you, Yelena.
Well, what I love about New Jersey, U.S. in general, we're a country of immigrants, and the immigration patterns do affect the changes in our disease patterns. So we have a large population of patients from Venezuela, Ukraine, Ecuador, and those patients do get Asia, and those patients do get gastric cancer. Overall, the rise of gastric cancer in young patients, patients under age 50, is alarming, and it's both G junction and stomach cancer, while H. pylori and your endemic type of gastric cancer, although it's still prevalent in folks that travel abroad or service in the military, overall is declining. So I think what you saw, the change, is that probably the cross-section of the population that is living in New Jersey, but in my clinic, it's the young onset tumors of G junction and gastric cancer are quite alarming, and similar to colon cancer, although we're not, you know, maybe Time Magazine worthy because it's an orphan disease, the reason why these tumor patients come in with early onset cancer is puzzling. Maybe it's microplastics or supplements, but we just don't know. I mean, there's some ideas about tumor microbiome and some of the bacteria that may be less protective, but it's all hand waving. So a lot of this research is ongoing.
Are you doing any microbiome work?
Yeah, we do. So we're collecting longitudinal samples from patients before they even start anything with me, either in early sort of early stage or advanced tumors, and if they go for surgery, because it's quite tricky to, you know, stomach is just so it's such a tolerant environment, and we're exposed to so much. It's so hard to know what to test, either the fluid or the tumor or the stool. But we're testing all of it. But some of this work and the prevention studies, it just takes too long to understand. So, you know, it may not even be conclusive in my lifetime as an oncologist, but we're trying.
Anything interesting so far?
There's some bacteria that may be, you know, there's some trends, but it's too preliminary.
Sam, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I'm in the Northeast in Boston, and most of our referral patterns are like New Hampshire, Maine, Vermont, and so a lot of like 65-year-old white guys with acid reflux getting GE junction cancers, that's what we see. But in the city population, which is more diverse, we see exactly as Dr. Janjigian was describing. I agree, we don't know the answer, you know. I don't think they know the answer for any of the epiphenomena that have been observed. Certainly, the global epidemiology in relation to H. pylori prevalence rates does kind of match up, you know, Korea, Japan, Chile, very, very high rates of H. pylori, very, very high rates of gastric cancer, a little more distal tumors. These are things that are known, but specifically within the cities, it's a mix.
So you were, Jelena got into the issue of upfront treatment of HER2-positive disease, and you're going to get into later line with T-DXd, but we have a case here, a 64-year-old African-American patient. Can you talk, Faye, a little bit about this man?
Yes, so this is a 64-year-old African-American man. So he presented with weight loss and abdominal pain. So he was diagnosed with gastric cancer, metastatic to liver and retroperitoneal lymphadenopathy. So the problem for him, he has a chronic renal insufficiency. It's hard to follow the imaging on those things. And then he got his tumor was HER2 3+, and the PD-L1 was 10% MSI stable. So family history was positive for mother with breast cancer, and he had a lot of comorbidities, and besides that, GI bleeding, and then quite anemic, required blood transfusion a lot. And so he received the FOLFOX, trastuzumab, nivolumab for 8 months, and then disease progression. Then he got one cycle of ramucirumab plus paclitaxel, then he had a stroke.
Oh.
So next line of treatment, I'm thinking, you know, what's the next thing I should do for him? T-DXd, irinotecan, Lonsurf, and if you say it's a T-DXd, so do you offer any other HER2 blockade on the way afterwards?
So Sam, why don't you dissect this one out a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Tough case. Sounds like real world case. You know, a lot of our patients have end organ dysfunction, liver, kidney abnormalities. I think we've all gotten good at managing FOLFOX through that. Ramucirumab has a known, you know, vascular thromboembolic event rate, and so that's within the spectrum, but unfortunate. I think very reasonable thing to have done. In this patient, I think I would offer them a trial of trastuzumab deruxtecan in the third line. We have some little bit less experience in people who were not fit on the trial in terms of their liver or end organ dysfunction, but starting off at doses of like 5.4, very, very reasonable. I've even taken periodically to extending the dose interval from 3 weeks to 4 weeks for people that have difficulty with the cycles. But given the activity of the drug in DESTINY-Gastric01, I think it'd be quite reasonable to offer that patient trastuzumab deruxtecan. In terms of other HER2 inhibitors, you know, we have a series of somewhat negative trials, and so it's zanidatamab is a newer drug that has some single agent activity, but of course is not available. So among the tools in the toolkit that are actually available to you, I would probably go with trastuzumab deruxtecan.
Well, Zani is approved in biliary, but
yes,
but I guess not in, you know, gastroesophageal. Yelena, any comments about using T-DXd? As you can imagine, we've talked about this a number of times. It's been interesting comparing the breast people to the GI people, the GYN, et cetera. Curious, first of all, what you think about this case, would you agree that TDXD would be indicated, and how do you approach the issue of, we've asked this, trying to compare notes, upfront management of nausea and vomiting, and how do you screen for ILD?
Yeah, well, so a couple of things. Considering how that IHC was 3+ and PD-L1 CPS 10, PFS of 9 months is a little short, so it's a little bit of an unusual case. So when that happens, it gives me a pause, and I always recommend a re-biopsy just to see. So what we saw the initial phase two with pembrotraz, and even in phase three, there's an unusual pattern of progression. In fact, the RECIST measurable lesions that are shrinking often continue to shrink, but then there's escape lesions with progression. So we always want to make sure, and with TDXT, it's in the package insert, to confirm that the tumor is HER2 positive, either by ctDNA or, you know, if you can. I mean, most of these patients have endoscopies that can be done safely. And so what I prioritize, if the HER2 positive is still positive, I tend to try to do TDXT in second line as opposed to third line, because the patients are more fit, they're more likely to get through therapy, particularly since we do start a 6.4 mg per kg dose of TDXT. To your point, I mean, I don't think we need probably that dose. In fact, DG03, our first line studies showed that 5.4 is just as probably good. So I would be, especially in patients where there's some kidney things or other functional status issues, be generous with dose reductions early. It is chemo. It's not, you know, immunotherapy or targeted therapies. I feel like sometimes patients misconstrued what TDXT is. So we start with Zofran, Reglan, often Amend, and I even give them Dex for 3 days just to go home with, just to have it for the first cycle.
Breast people use a lot of olanzapine.
Olanzapine too. Yeah, I mean, the problem, I mean, now that zolbetuximab is and everybody's on everything, it's a lot. It's a full-time job coaching these patients to be compliant with their nausea meds. And as, you know, because I'm on steering committees for a lot of these Claudin ADCs, I don't think the PIs at the sites or investigators understand the scope of how important these nausea meds are. So they're like, well, take it. You know, they give them all the information, but you really have to browbeat into the care team that you have to take these meds. And I think with TDXT, it's the same. ILD is not that big of a deal, especially in our patients, who the truth is their duration of treatment is not as long as breast. And again, if you use it in second line, you're more likely to get the drug into them. In this patient right here, I mean, I don't think zanidatamab is going to do anything, because, you know, if he progressed so fast on tras, pembro, my sense is that maybe the tumor biology is different. I sense it's probably EGFR, you know, altered, and HER2 is probably focal and may not be so important. So before you jump into TDXD, I would, especially, I mean, I don't know what his functional status is, but I'm sure it's not any better with a stroke. I would.
Yeah, that actually, because we couldn't see by the scans the disease progression until we did another endoscopy and saw the big tumor actually regrow.
Well, so that's the thing. If you can't scan them, how do you know the systemic disease is progressing? So if it's just primary tumor, those patients tend to not respond to chemotherapy anyway. So I said I don't radiate people except that case. Then I would radiate them.
What about not necessarily in this
But why case. Can't, you could get an MRI or a PET, you know, get something.
HER2 low, 1+, 2+, if you could, would you use TDXD if you had no
we
other option?
We have DG03 now, the only arm that's open on DG03, which is the first-line TDXD study that Sam, I think, will cover, is dual PD-1 TIGIT plus CAPE and TDXD.
Wow, interesting.
So it's the kitchen sink.
Yeah.
But you'll see the data. It, all right. I think you should enroll in the study.
Sam?
It's a first line. All right, so I'm going to talk about some newer targets and Claudin as was mentioned. Here's my disclosures. So we'll talk a little bit about biomarker testing and overlap in gastric and GE junction, dive into Claudin, some newer Claudin drugs, and then talk about a few other ADCs. So this is probably not so dissimilar from Faye's case. You know, this is sort of run-of-the-mill disease that walks into our clinic, which unfortunately is over half of our patients are metastatic at the time of diagnosis, so this is a not uncommon PET CT. And here you see someone who is the real world. They're CPS positive with a score of 4, and they're also Claudin positive. So what would you do with this patient? You know, there is no perfect biomarker, unlike cats. There is no perfect biomarker in gastric cancer. We have a suite of biomarkers now and I put the prevalence here just for reference. So MSI is wonderful. We're very much excited when we see that, but it's rare. 15 to 20% of people are HER2 positive, so about 1 out of 5. And then we see about 80% of people are PD-L1 positive using a CPS of 1 or more. And then claudin, which is the newest biomarker, it's about 40% of the people that walk through your door are going to be claudin positive. This is the distribution. Just when we say positive, in the trials that led to zolbetuximab approval, the cut point was 75% of tumor cells at moderate or strong intensity. So that's about 40% of patients. But you can see here that about 75% of patients are actually claudin positive if you were to use a different cut point. And that becomes relevant when you start talking about ADCs, which try to lower the threshold for activity, because they're really just looking for like a landing target for the drug. People ask a lot, what is the overlap for all these biomarkers? So I put together a table for everybody's reference, and FGFR2B is the next one to come, but no one has done the comparative studies yet. But if you look at claudin positive and claudin negative gastric or GE junction cancers, and you ask, what is the rate of PD-L1 positive or negative, it's basically the same. Claudin sort of runs through all these other biomarker subsets. What's the biology of this? Well, it is a tight junction protein, so if you zoom in on the gastric differentiated epithelium, there's several protein families involved in tight junctions, and claudin is one of this tetraspanin tight junction proteins. And when it gets, when tumors become tumors, they lose their normal architecture, and so this typically intercellular tight junction protein is then displayed on the surface and accessible for multiple potential targets, CAR T cells, ADCs, antibodies, et cetera. So that observation was made some years ago, and it was quite an attractive observation because you have a target that is inherently only really expressed in tumor cells and the normal stomach and not expressed anywhere else in the body. So it's very attractive from a drug development standpoint, thinking that we have some tumor specificity built in. This was the study. There's also the GLOW study, but because most of us use FOLFOX, it's FOLFOX plus or minus claudin 18 antibody. This is the survival curve. This is the New England Journal with the merge data from SPOTLIGHT and GLOW, because SPOTLIGHT was perhaps a little bit above what we might have expected. But I also highlight that most of these biologic trials, whether it's immunotherapy, zolbetuximab, trastuzumab, they have a tail compared to combinations that don't have a biologic in them. And you can see that the tail is actually relatively comparable to what you see with immunotherapy. In other first-line trials, again, here is 649, SPOTLIGHT and GLOW, and 811. We continue to see the tail in the biologics. And at 3 years, I just highlighted the three-year rate, 17%, 20%. HER2 is different. They get about 30% three-year survival. So we're moving the needle, and all of these biologics seem to flatten out the curves. The toxicity for zolbetuximab is no joke. Now that the drug, you probably have all given it after its approval in October of 2024, but it's nausea and vomiting. These are class effects of claudin drugs. It happens. It's about 80% of people will get nausea of any grade. About 65% of people will have actual vomiting. What do you do about this? Well, one, as Dr. Janjigian was highlighting, we do try to throw the kitchen sink at these people. But it is also something you can tell patients that after these initial infusion or so, it does tend to get better. And that has been my own experience as well. We also tried to put together some evidence-based guidelines from investigators on these trials about what to do. And so here is just a paper you can all refer to and a flow sheet, which may be helpful. But interrupting the infusion actually tends to treat the nausea quite well, although it can result in long days for patients. If you move beyond zolbetuximab, you've heard about ADCs. We were just talking about TDXD. There's a lot of reasons why ADCs are good drugs. Essentially, there's a whole bunch of them in claudin. Based on the tumor specificity, I highlight a couple here just by payload. So AstraZeneca has AZD0901. There's this Elevation Oncology drug, EO2021. Those are both MMAE payloads, so taxane-based payloads. IBI-343 and SHRA-1904, which are topoisomerase payloads. And those are the predominant payloads in all ADCs. And then, of course, when you think about claudin, there's a whole bunch of other ways you could come at it. You could think about bispecific T-cell engagers. You know, we just have this new drug for small cell lung cancer, tarlatamab, really showing that bispecifics with CD3 and DLL3. In that case, same idea here. There's a Claudin 18.2 by CD3 from AstraZeneca. There's one from Astellas, and then these other two drugs from IMAB as well. These drugs are active. Like other ADCs, we do see activity. So this is AZD0901, formerly CMG901. So it's a Claudin ADC, in this case with an MMAE payload. Many of us in our sites have the global phase 3 second line plus Clarity trial. So this is investigator choice chemo, so it could be Taxol Ram, could be irinotecan against Claudin 18 ADC. And here is the preliminary data that supported that. So you see this nice waterfall plot. These are heavily pretreated patients with a lower Claudin threshold. So here it was 20% of tumor cells. So they're pushing the bar down compared to what we saw with zolbetuximab. And you can still see that the majority of patients have some numerical tumor shrinkage, and the response rate in small numbers ranges somewhere from 25 to 35% response rate. And this has actually been seen, no surprise, for other ADCs as well. So here's IBI-343 and SHR-A1904. Again, all showing proof of principle that Claudin 18.2 ADCs do have sufficient activity to warrant further exploration. And most of these are in phase 3 trials now. Again, toxicity from ADCs. About the same rates, Neil, as you mentioned, of ILD and pneumonitis as we saw with TDXD trials. This is around 6%. And I'm pulling from AZD0901 here because it's the largest data set. You also see a lot of chemo-like side effects. Decreased appetite, 42% of people. Weight loss, half the patients. We see some cytopenias, anemia, thrombocytopenia, neutropenia. These are all things that, as oncologists, of course, we're used to seeing. But the addition of it being a Claudin 18 target, you see the vomiting rates here, again, even with ADCs and naked antibodies, closer to 50%. So as Dr. Janjigian was mentioned, you know, the prophylaxis and the management is a key part to get people these drugs. This was actually quite interesting, and I think we'll see the data at ASCO. But just a couple weeks ago, CARSgen, and many of you have heard about this, Claudin CAR-T, released a press release saying that their second-line randomized trial for Claudin 18 CAR-T was positive for PFS. So this is the first CAR-T in gastric cancer, or maybe most GI cancers, to demonstrate a positive in a randomized phase 2 setting. So we'll see the data. So Claudin 18.2, there's a whole spectrum of therapy. Zolbetuximab is restricted really to the very top end of Claudin expression. That's where the activity is. ADCs and CAR-Ts look to leverage the target specificity but expand the population who might benefit by lowering the threshold for the most part. And then there are about a third of patients who are completely Claudin negative, and those patients clearly need to be prioritized to other therapies. There are other targets, of course, beyond Claudin, which I've spent the beginning talking about. At ASCO GI, we saw an attempt to build a CD47 on top of trastuzumab and ramucirumab and paclitaxel in this small trial over here on the left. I think this is a little bit late because now we have TDXD and we'll see DG04, but TDXD, like other ADCs, gives encouraging outcomes. You see DESTINY-Gastric01 and 02 here, response rates around 50%, and some of these responses are quite durable, and the responses and the overall survival in these trials is quite favorable. So there's a lot of ways and reasons to think that we can build upon TDXD, and this is data that Dr. Janjigian had presented at ESMO and followed up, but you can see this is attempt to move TDXD into the front line primarily, and there's a lot of combinations being explored. I'm not going to dwell on all the data, but really the take home is this drug can work in the second line. It has demonstrated activity in the third line in DG01 and now has proven activity, response rate activity in the front line in various combinations. I think picking the ideal combination to go forward and how we'll see is something that's ongoing. DESTINY-Gastric04 is a data set that many of us have been waiting on for a while. You know, we've had TDXD approvals based on survival in DESTINY-Gastric01 and PFS and response in DESTINY-Gastric02, but there is no randomized phase 3 data until this trial that says TDXD is better than Taxol Ram. We all have our preferences, and many of us use HER2 rebiopsy as a guide, but here we will actually have some data at ASCO that will tell us, in a randomized phase 3 setting, did TDXD beat Taxol and Ramucirumab? And I think we all have our own hypothesis, but are quite eager to see this data. There are many other targets. FGFR2B is probably the next one that's going to be coming. Maybe next year, if I get invited back, Neil, we'll have FGFR2B to talk about. But this is also a relatively prevalent biomarker. So if you look at FGFR2B across all samples, and this is screening samples from Fortitude 101, which was a big phase 3 trial, you can see that the about 3,700 patients screened, and this is a real-world distribution of clinical features. But depending on the cut point that you use, it's somewhere between like almost 40% of patients who are positive. And then the trial was amended to look at the top echelon of the biomarker, so the people who were seeming to derive the greatest benefit. And in that setting, it's about 16% of people are FGFR2B positive at that threshold down there, 10% of tumor cells showing 2 and 3 plus intensity. And the reason that people, the trial was amended to increase the biomarker selection is shown over here on the right. So the curves have a greater degree of separation if you cut the biomarker at a greater point. So there was a decision made to revise the cut point and focus on this higher cut point based on the prior trial data. A bunch of other targets to come. I think there's a lot of enthusiasm. It's a great time to be doing stomach and esophageal cancer. We see VEGF pathway has demonstrated activity in multiple cancers, and now there's sort of new ways. There's these PD-1 VEGF bispecifics like the Akeso compound or Summit compound that's shown a positive phase 3 against Pembro in lung cancer. A lot of these tumors have some poor differentiation features and EMT activation, so YAPT and FAK are ways to attack EMT. And then there's numerous strategies to try to continue to target T-cell exhaustion pathways. So there's a big phase 3 trial that Dr. Janjigi and I are both involved in, comparing chemo plus PD-1 plus or minus TIGIT to see if you can continue to push on the T-cell exhaustion angle to improve the proportion of people who benefit. They're stepping on the gas strategies, which have been very hard to develop. There's myeloid targeting strategies, and then there's a whole bunch of other targets. And I think the point here is that the universe of gastric and GE junction cancers is expanding, and these conferences become more and more fun as we try to tease apart this data, and it's a great thing for patients that we actually have data to talk about. A final message is, you know, I think most of us who are here have already come here or watching online because they have an interest and they recognize a need to learn and be educated about biomarkers. Even though we all talk about this in the real world, so this is real world data over time, 2019 to 2023, you can see that we've gotten very good at standardizing MSI testing. Basically, everybody's getting MSI testing. But HER2 testing and PD-L1 testing, which are the lighter colors, less darker down, you can see that it has increased, but still, even in the real world, there are like almost 20 or 30% of people who are not getting tested for standard biomarkers. And some of this has to do with tissue availability, and I think this is an area that there's a lot of work, practical work to be done about educating GI colleagues about tissue needed, IR colleagues about tissue needed, because this slide is outdated already. It doesn't contain claudin. It's not going to have FGFR2B, so there's going to be more biomarkers to test. And I think that is the message that I will leave you with.
So just a couple of final questions. Yelena, Sam talked about this trial, randomizing paclitaxel versus TDXD for HER2 positive second line, but what's your current approach? So where do you put in TDXD?
So that study actually was initially our study, and then because the FDA approved TDXD in second line in the United States, we had to not open it in U.S. So I tend to prefer TDXD in second line, especially if HER2 is known to be high.
Quick case from the audience. Back to you, Yelena from Priya, who has a patient with HER2-positive metastatic esophageal cancer to the brain, status post-resection, followed by recurrence in the brain, followed by SBRT, no evidence of disease elsewhere. We heard earlier in this conference about the effect of TDXD in breast cancer in the brain, very effective. Now, a typical second-line therapy. Have you seen brain mets with HER2-positive gastroesophageal, and what kind of activity of T-DXd would you think about it for a patient like this?
Absolutely. The truth is, if they live long enough, all of our patients develop brain mets, and many of them may have small volume disease we're not picking up. So I have used, and we actually have a window of opportunity T-DXd study, then patients go on for resection. It's been kind of disappointing overall, but I mean, it's small volume of patients, so I think that it's definitely worthwhile to try if the patient has good quality of functional status. Certainly, tucatinib may have also activity in the central nervous system, but once the brain mets take off the leptomeningeal disease, it's going to be hard to do anything.
Yeah, it's interesting how TDXD sort of jumped over tucatinib and brain mets with breast cancer. Sam, really exciting about this CAR T. Do you see cytokine release syndrome, neurologic ICANS?
Yeah, they do. So I personally have no experience with this CAR T product, but it was a trial that was open in the U.S. and has been primarily developed in China and Asia. But yes, they definitely see CRS, including some high-grade CRS. You know, patients are admitted for observation. It's a complex regimen. There's lymphodepletion preceding the CAR T. Patients need to be admitted for that. So it is not a straightforward protocol, but in appropriately selected patients, it can be administered. So I think it will be, now that we know the trial is positive, how to actually implement this across the board in practice is going to be really not so straightforward, but a lot of work for all of us.
We have the study open, and I can tell you practically, you have to have a FACT-accredited center to do it, and only certain doctors, even within our center. So I have FACT accreditation, but it takes a whole thing. You have to treat myeloma patients also and so forth. And for most patients, even small volume disease patients, it's not a practical approach because the patients have to be prepared for this and then be off some sort of systemic therapy and then get admitted. They have to all live within 2 hours from the center. So many of our patients move to New York for this. So I think, as Sam said, it's nice to have proof of principle, but what we really will need is off-the-shelf products, cellular therapy products, allogenic or otherwise, to be able to really move this forward.
Maybe bispecific. So let's just finish out with zolbetuximab. And Faye has a 32, he's talking about younger patients, 32-year-old Ecuadorian man with stage 4 signet ring cell gastric cancer, claudin 18.2 positive. Have you used zolbetuximab? I know you're thinking about, are you going to use it in this man? Have you used zolbetuximab before?
No, this is really young professional just like us. And then he continues working. And then he's the one, he understands all the treatment, you know. Even he brings the NG suction going home because he knows his metastatic disease mainly is the peritoneal carcinomatosis and then the esophageal and the bowel stricture. So it's just look at him losing weight and then just miserable. So he received the FOLFOX and nivolumab as the first line, and then he the special thing for him, he was diagnosed with Lynch syndrome. Mm. So he was PMS2 insufficient, and then so but the tumor by itself is exactly. And then as the family history, his father carries this PMS, but the whole family history, look, it's only the paternal grandmother thyroid cancer, nothing else. So he's the lucky one. And then so now he progressed, and then with the FOLFOX plus nivolumab, and then now it's he carries this CLDN18 positivity. I was thinking, you know, is the candidate for zolbetuximab, and then also how about dual immunotherapy?
Mm. So that's, I think what this case brings up two important points. Just because the patient is Lynch, do not assume that their gastric cancer is Lynch related. So I've seen this I've seen three cases where the patient is referred to me from Lynch. They assume the tumor is MSI. We test and it's MSS. And obviously this patient sounds like didn't do so well on first-line immune checkpoint blockade. I think the likelihood they're going to respond to immunotherapy beyond that point is low. I mean, certainly you can try Nivo-Ipi later on, but typically the issue is that now that zolbetuximab is approved in first-line, a patient who has been on first-line and has progressed, if you call them progression, you won't be able to get, I mean, I've even with all of my resources in nursing and appeals and letters, I've not ever been able to get these patients zolbetuximab. So what I do often, and you know, hopefully this is not recorded, is if it's kind of equivocal and it's not definitive progression, we just pivot to FOLFOX Zolbi in first line without switching first line therapy, because that's the only way right now for a patient like this, you will be able to get claudin inhibitor because he's likely not measurable, so you won't be able to put him on a claudin ADC study in second line. And so for this young patient, the only way to get any claudin inhibitors would be in standard of care. So, but there's really no other, you know, targeted therapy beyond claudin inhibitors that are sure to help him. Certainly, you know, Taxol ramucirumab is a good fallback, but I would, try to, so even your patients now that are on first-line therapy, if you know they're claudin positive, and we know from Armani study that pivoting to second-line therapy may be actually a good thing, so just pivot to zolbetuximab-based therapy early.
The final question to Sam. Any pearls about the nausea and vomiting that you see with zolbetuximab? This is different because it's a direct effect on the stomach. I've heard people talk about slowing the infusion down. What are any sort of pearls of advice?
Yeah, I think one of the keys is educating the patients. You know, people don't like surprises. And so if you tell them that, hey, look, this drug works, but you got to go through this, like, people will understand. They have cancer. They're willing to do what they think will be best. And so I think education is a big part. You know, when I see patients, I tell them, look, there's probably a good chance you're going to throw up in the infusion center. We're going to do everything we can. May give you a little bit of more sedating drugs so you kind of sleep through it. Patients, I would say that's a little pearl. In Japan, they do a lot of Benadryl and Ativan to just kind of sedate people, and then they don't throw up. But interrupting the infusion for 30 to 45 minutes makes a big difference. The nausea does fade away. You can usually resume at the same rate or at a, you know, slightly slower rate as many infusion teams are used to. But it does make a difference. I think at our center, we've gotten everyone we've treated through the infusion so far. Sometimes it's a long day, which is another piece of education. We tend not to split it out into 2 days, like do zolbetuximab one day, come back for your FOLFOX. Patients don't like that. I wouldn't like that if I was a patient. But I would say pre-medications, education, and don't hold back on interrupting the infusion would be the key.
Awesome. So, well, we're about done. Come on back next year. Thank you so much. Have a great day.